Part 8. Doing the Wild Card Shuffle.
You can take the boy out of Bayonne, but you can't take Bayonne out of the boy. The same is true of funny books, I admit it. Cut me, and I still bleed four-colored ink. Maybe I don't know the name of the current Green Lantern, but I can still recite Hal Jordan's oath and tell you how it differed from the one that Alan Scott once swore when he recharged his ring. I can name all of the challenges of the unknown for you and give you the original lineup of the Avengers, the X-Men, and the Justice League of America. Do I really have to include Snapper Carr? I have no doubt that in some alternate universe, Marvel Comics did hire me when I applied in 1971. And right now, in that world, I am sitting at home, muttering and gnawing at my wrists as I watch blockbuster movies based on my characters and stories rake in hundreds of millions of dollars while I receive exactly nothing. In this world, I was spared that fate. In this world, I wrote short stories and novellas and novels instead of funny books, and later on, screenplays and teleplays as well. Yet that love of superheroes never left me, even when I was well established as a pro. I still had one more good tech story in me, I figured. Maybe more than one, but one for sure. A gritty, hard-nosed tale about what might befall a would-be superhero in the real world. The germ of the notion went back years and years, but for most of that time it remained no more than a few lines in my files. A kid like me, raised on comic books, finds himself blessed, or is it cursed, with an actual superpower. What would he do with it? Ignore it? Exploit it? Try to don a spandex costume and fight crime? How would it change his life? How would the real world react to someone who actually did possess powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men? That was my working title, "With Powers and Abilities Far Beyond Those of Mortal Men." The phrase is from the old Superman TV show, of course, and I later learned that DC Comics had trademarked it, so it was just as well that I never used it. Precisely what those powers and abilities should be, I never did work out, which may be why I never wrote the story. For a long time, I leaned toward pyrokinesis, until Stephen King came out with Firestarter in 1980. Not only did King's novel feature a girl who could ignite fires with her mind, but it also gave her father a superpower of his own, a kind of mind control. Though my handling of the theme would have been very different, I could not help feeling as though King had beaten me to the punch. My life was changing in more important ways in 1980, though. At the end of 1979, I had left my teaching job at Clark College and moved from Iowa to New Mexico to try to make a go of it as a full-time writer. My marriage had ended in the course of the move, so I arrived in the land of enchantment a single man again. Santa Fe has remained my home ever since. Though I ended up spending years in Los Angeles working in television and film, I never truly moved there. Instead, I would rent a furnished apartment in one of the sprawling Oakwood complexes, or a guest house at someone's backyard. But the moment my current project wrapped, I would be on the road again, headed home to New Mexico. Santa Fe was the place where I hung my hats and paid my taxes, the place where I kept my books and my funny books, and the old double-breasted pinstripe mustard yellow sports jacket that had not fit me for a decade. And Santa Fe was where Paris was, too, holding down the fort. We'd met at a convention in 1975, a few months before I entered into my ill-considered marriage. I knew I liked her the moment she told me that A Song for Laia made her cry. Well, she was a stone fox, too, and we were both naked when we met, but never mind about that, it's none of your business. Paris and I stayed in touch after that con, exchanging occasional letters through all the years when I was teaching Catholic girls, and she was selling snow cones and shoveling elephant dung for Ringling Brothers. In 1981, we got together at another convention, and she came to Santa Fe to stay with me for a while. That while will have lasted 26 years by the time you hear this. Now and again, one of my readers will ask me why I don't write sad stories of unrequited love any longer, the way I did so often in the 70s. Paris is to blame for that. You can only write that stuff when your heart is broken. When I first moved to Santa Fe in the wake of my divorce, I knew no one in the city but Roger Zelazny, and him only slightly. Roger took me under his wing. On the first Friday of every month, we would drive down to Albuquerque to lunch with Tony Hillerman, Norm Zollinger, Fred Saberhagen, and the other New Mexico writers. I also dropped in on the Albuquerque SF Club, where I met the local fans and still more writers and aspiring writers. Before very long, I found myself gaming with some of them. Though I had been a serious chess player from 7th grade through college and enjoyed Risk and Diplomacy and other board games, I had never played Dungeons & Dragons or any other role-playing game until I moved to New Mexico. Paris had, however, and she convinced me to give it a try. The bunch that we fell in with were mostly hardcore fans, and half of them were writers. At the time Paris and I joined the group, they were playing Chaosium's Call of Cthulhu, based on the work of H.P. Lovecraft, so I felt right at home. Since the rest of the party were all intrepid adventurers determined to save the world from the Cthulhu cults, I played a journalist who was yellow in both senses of the word. As my friends died screaming or went insane, I would run away to cable my story to the Herald. Our sessions were like some madcap improv theater with Shuggoths. Before the year was out, I had become so enamored of gaming that I was running a Call of Cthulhu campaign of my own. I'd found that I enjoyed being a game master even more than being a player. Which brings us to September 1983, when Vic Milan presented me with a new game for my birthday. Superworld reawakened a frustrated comic book writer inside me and soon replaced Call of Cthulhu as the group's favorite game. We played it obsessively for more than a year, two or three times a week, and no one became more obsessed than me. As game master, I found myself dusting off old characters like Manta Ray and coming up with new ones, villains chiefly, plus one hero who floated around in an iron shell and called himself the Great and Powerful Turtle. My players, half of whom were writers, created some unforgettable characters of their own. Yeoman, Crypt Kicker, Peregrine, Elephant Girl, Modular Man, Captain Trips, Straight Arrow, Black Shadow, Topper, and the Harlem Hammer were only a few of the strange and wondrous folks who first made their appearance in our Superworld sessions. The tale of how Superworld ultimately begat Wild Cards is one I've told numerous times before, most notably in the afterwards for the iBooks reissues of the early volumes of the series. I won't repeat myself here. The reissues are easily available for those who would like to read the grisly details. Suffice it to say that a number of us fell in love with our characters and began to think that they might have possibilities beyond the game. Shared worlds were all the rage in the early 80s, thanks to the tremendous success of the Thieves' World anthologies edited by Bob Asprin and Lynn Abbey. The format was perfect for what we wanted to do with our Superworld characters, so I pitched the idea to my fellow gamers, filled out our ranks by recruiting Roger Zelazny, Howard Waldrop, Lou Scheiner, Stephen Lay, and half a dozen other writers from all across the country, and drew up a formal proposal for a three-volume anthology series called Wild Cards. Shauna McCarthy bought it, her first day on the job as an editor at Bantam Books. All shared worlds are collaborations to a greater or lesser extent. Looking over Thieves' World and its imitators, I realized that the shared worlds that worked the best were those that shared the most, where the storylines and characters were the most tightly intertwined. Right from the first, therefore, we resolved that Wild Cards would be more than just a collection of loosely connected stories set against a common background. We wanted to take the art of collaboration to a whole new level. To signal our intent, we called the books mosaic novels rather than anthologies. I do think we succeeded for the most part, but as with any new form, there were bumps in the road and lessons that we had to learn the hard way. Editing a series, I often felt like the ringmaster at a nine-ring circus, trying to keep order with a whip made out of spaghetti. Some days it was fun, some days it was frustrating, but it was never, ever tedious. When everything was going smoothly, I liked to compare us to a symphony orchestra with me as the conductor. But a closer metaphor might be a herd of cats. We all know how easy it is to herd cats, don't we? So here's to all the members of the Wild Cards Consortium, as zany and talented a bunch of cats as any editor could ever hope to herd. Roger Zelazny, Howard Waldrop, Walter John Williams, Stephen Lay, Gail Gerstner Miller, Louis Scheiner, John J. Miller, Victor Milan, Walton Bud Simons, Arthur Byron Cover, William F. Wu, Laura J. Mixon, Michael Cassett, Sage Walker, Edward Bryant, Leanne C. Harper, Kevin Andrew Murphy, Steve Perrin, Paris, Royce Weidman, Pat Cadigan, Chris Claremont, Bob Wayne, and Daniel Abraham. And most of all, here's to Melinda M. Snodgrass, my tireless assistant editor, without whose diplomatic intercessions I would surely have killed and butchered at least four of the aforementioned. Wild Cards was a hit right from the first, and not only by anthology standards. The sales of the first volume exceeded the sales of any of my novels to date, save Fever Dream alone, and the later books would be almost as successful. The reviews were excellent, by and large. Walter John Williams' story in the first book was a finalist for the Nebula, one of the few shared world stories ever accorded that honor. And the series as a whole was nominated for the Hugo Award, losing in 1988 at New Orleans to Alan Moore's splendid graphic novel, Watchmen. Bantam was only too pleased to make an offer for three more volumes after the first three had been delivered. Our advances rose and rose again. The series became a popular topic for Worldcon panels, and two regional conventions chose Wild Cards themes and brought in all the authors as guests of honor. Marvel Comics did a Wild Card miniseries under its Epic imprint, and Steve Jackson Games issued a role-playing game, bringing us full circle. Hollywood was heard from, too. Disney Studios optioned the film rights to the books, and Melinda Snodgrass and I wrote several drafts of a Wild Card screenplay in the early 90s. The series began at virtually the same time as my association with The Twilight Zone and continued through my three seasons on Beauty and the Beast, through all my feature assignments and television pilots. That steady stream of books with my name on the covers undoubtedly helped keep me alive in the worlds of science fiction and fantasy. Just as I had to return to Santa Fe from time to time during my Hollywood years to remind myself of who I was and where I lived, I had to keep publishing books and short story as well. If I hadn't, well, readers have short memories, I fear, and in recent years they've only gotten shorter. Given the long hours and high stress levels so typical of Hollywood, the last thing that any television producer needs is a second job, but I had one, courtesy of Wild Cards. Not only did I edit the books, but I wrote for them as often as I could find the time. Shell Games, my principal contribution to Volume 1, had antecedents that went way back. The bones of the story were ones I'd been gnawing on for years before I ever heard of Superworld. This was, with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men, reworked to fit our new shared universe. Never throw anything away. I'd intended to use pyrokinesis for my hero's power until Firestarter, but telekinesis worked just as well. The great and powerful Turtle began life as a minor character in our Superworld campaign, but would soon become quite a major one in Wild Cards. Mind you, a story and a game have very different needs, and what works splendidly for one may not work at all for the other, so the Turtle changed quite a bit before he hit the page. Shell Games was not his tale alone, though. He shared the stage with Dr. Tachyon, a character created by Melinda Snodgrass. Working with other people's characters is one of the challenges of doing a shared world. It is often a lot of fun and often a huge headache. Sometimes it is both at once. In her story, Degradation Rites, which preceded mine in Wild Cards, Melinda told how Dr. Tachyon had inadvertently destroyed the mind of a woman he loved in an effort to protect the identity of his ace patients from UEC. The experience had destroyed Dr. Tachyon as well, and thereafter he had collapsed into a decade-long orgy of guilt, self-recrimination, and alcoholism. It was my job to drag him out of his funk in Shell Games and set him back on the path to recovery, while also introducing my own characters. If you have read this far, you will soon realize that Thomas Tudbury is far and away the most autobiographical of all the characters I've ever created. That being said, there are important differences as well. Though I cannibalized many elements of my own childhood for Tom's, I also changed some crucial things. In real life, I never had a friend like Junkyard Joey DeAngelis, though many was the time I wished for one, especially one like the Joey of the screenplay, who Melinda and I changed into a girl. I had two terrific sisters, while Tom was an only child. Oh, and the real me never developed kick-ass telekinesis either, more's the pity. Not all of the characters in Wild Cards had antecedents in our Superworld campaigns. Many were entirely original. Among those were Howard Waldrop's Jet Boy, Lou Shiner's heroic pimp Fortunato, Steve Lay's sinister puppet man, and Roger Zelazny's sleeper, Croyd Crenson, who drew the wild card during a long walk home from school one day and never learned algebra. Jay Aykroyd, a.k.a. Poppin' Jay, my other major character in the series, was one of those as well. Jay was first mentioned in Aces High, our second volume, but did not come on stage until the third, Joker's Wild, where he teams up with Hiram Worcester for most of my storyline. As the series went on, Aykroyd came more and more to the fore and starred in several stories of his own. By the end of our Bantam run, Jay had become almost as popular as the Turtle. Tom and Jay were not the only arrows in my quiver. From time to time, I would choose to tell a story from the viewpoint of one of my other myriad lesser characters. The focus of my interstitial narrative in Aces High was Jube the Walrus, an alien in a Hawaiian shirt and pork pie hat. In Joker's Wild, my story featured Hiram Worcester, the urbane and portly proprietor of the restaurant atop the Empire State Building. For Dealer's Choice, I used a character created by Bud Simons, the body snatcher Zelda, to give the reader a better picture of what the bad guys were up to on the rocks. The Journal of Xavier Desmond is a story of another of my secondary players, a Joker activist who had first appeared in Shell Games as the maitre d' of the Funhouse. Dez had risen in the world since then, and as the de facto mayor of Jokertown, it seemed a natural choice to become one of the Joker delegates on the global fact-finding tour that provided the spine for our fourth volume, Aces Abroad. The Turtle could not very well go, since he never left his shell, nor was Jay Aykroyd likely to be invited. Hiram Worcester would be, of course, and I could have chosen him to be my protagonist, but I had just done Hiram in the third book, and I wanted to try a Joker perspective. The interstitial narrative was one of the toughest assignments in any Wildcards book. In a mosaic novel, you want the whole to be more than the sum of its parts. If each story was a brick, the interstitial was the mortar that made them a wall. Whoever wrote the interstitial had to wait until the other stories were done, read the first drafts to see where the holes were, then try to patch them over, while also telling a good story of his own. If the interstitial was just filler, the book would fall apart. Later, in the history of Wildcards, other writers would step forward to do the interstitials. Bud Simons took a crack at it, and Steve Lay let himself be drafted more than once. In the early volumes, however, the task usually fell to me as editor. The Journal of Xavier Desmond is my favorite of those interstitial stories and represents some of the best work I did for Wildcards. This is the first time it has been presented by itself, shorn of the stories it originally wove through and around. Nothing goes on forever. After a good long run, the Wildcard series began to lose steam. The books had gotten darker, and they had been pretty dark to begin with, and sales were declining with each volume, slowly but steadily. Some of our best writers had gone on to other projects. Popular characters had died or retired. The books were still outselling most paperbacks by a healthy margin, but we were definitely on the downslope. When our contract came up for renewal, Bantam offered us the same terms for the next triad that we'd received for the last two. Foolishly, perhaps, we rejected that offer and took the series to a smaller publisher for a substantial raise. It was a bad mistake. Though we got more money in the short run, our new publisher lacked both Bantam's resources and Bantam's commitment to the series. Without new titles in the pipeline, Bantam soon allowed the first 12 books to go out of print. Not only did our backlist sales dry up, but new readers no longer had an easy entry to the world by way of Volume 1. We tried to get around that by scrapping the old numbering and promoting Volume 13 as Book 1 of a new series, but Card Sharks remained a confusing read for readers not familiar with all that had gone before. Sales dropped precipitously, and after the publication of the 15th volume in 1995, we found ourselves without a publisher. And that was the end of that. "But with strange eons, even death may die," said H.P. Lovecraft. In 2001, Wildcards returned with a brand new publisher. After a 7-year hiatus, Deuces Down, the 16th volume in the series, was released in 2002 with all new stories, followed by Death Draws 5 in 2006. Volumes 18, 19, and 20 are in the pipeline, and the old books are being re-released for a new generation of readers. Once more, we're hearing talk of games and comic books and movie options. Will any of this come to pass? Damned if I know. I wouldn't bet against us, though. There's a certain Turtle I know who has already had more lives than any cat.